This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Another Wall Street Dow Jones Industrial Average record. The stock market seems like record setter Jamaican runner Usain Bolt.
Bolt stretching out now. He's coming after him. He's immortal now. Usain's done it.
Everybody is not an Olympic runner, though. The Dow had 9 straight days of record highs until this past Tuesday. Even Usain Bolt apparently has to walk to his car. And you would feel very boltish if you understood, like Berkeley economist Emmanuel Saez, economist Gabriel Zucman, and Thomas Piketty, who show that the overwhelming majority of income gains have gone to the ultra-rich in recent decades. Since 1980, the post-tax income growth of the top 1% has grown by 194%, the top 0.1% by 298%, the top 0.01% by 423%, and the top 0.001% by 616%. Now, that's a group of Usain Bolts who win the economic race without ever having to train or even run. The money just runs to them.
I'm Amy from Johnston, Rhode Island. My income keeps going down.
This New England listener, it's safe to say, does not feel like Usain Bolt.
I am working fewer hours than I used to. For now, my income is held down by my kids' needs for me to be there for them and by their need for services that are only available in our state through Medicaid. We have to live at the just above poverty level income guidelines that haven't been increased in decades, at least until they turn 18 and no longer look at my salary.
Now, if the economy is like a track meet, to keep the metaphor going, the rest of the runners on the track, no matter how they're trying, would look like they're going backwards or nowhere, according to that study by Saez, Piketty, and Zucman. Income gains for the middle class have stayed relatively stagnant since 1980, growing by less than half of the top 10%, even as unemployment in July matched a 16-year low touched in May. In 2015, Sir Angus Deaton, a Princeton-based economist who won the Nobel Prize that same year, published a paper with his colleague and his wife Anne Case that found the mortality rates of white men and women in the U.S. between 1999 and 2013 were increasing, reversing decades of progress that no other rich country experienced. White privilege, among the most durable, safest bets in the U.S. economy, was apparently evaporating in men and women without a high school degree, aged 45 to 54, particularly among people with a deterioration in economic and social well-being. They were just dying by drugs, alcohol, and suicide. Deaths of despair, Deaton called them. I asked Sir Angus Deaton how overall economic success generates, of all things, despair.
Inequality is often a byproduct of progress, and it has been historically. And we don't want to choke off the progress that produces that sort of inequality. But inequality is very, very dangerous, too. But I don't think it's really very helpful to have an anti-inequality strategy as opposed to having a strategy that tries to mitigate the negative effects of inequality.
Would you describe the turning point that politicians often talk about, that the current voting generation, to use the United States as an example, does not believe it will be better off than its parents were? Do you believe Right. that milestone is very, very significant of a turning point, either in a country or an economy?
Yes, I think that has been important. And I think some of the really bad things we're seeing in the United States now, like the epidemic of deaths of despair that Anne Case and I have been talking about, we think that's very much associated with the phenomenon you talk about. That if you were born when I was born, immediately after the Second World War, more than 90% were better off than their parents quite early in their lives. And then if you go 20 years later, that's not true anymore. So it's not just the current generation. I mean, it's people in their 40s and 50s now whose lives have just not panned out the way that they could reasonably have hoped for when they started.
How do you reconcile the, and you describe the deaths of despair, but yet the, you know, stock market is setting records every single day. How do you reconcile those things?
You know, I don't think people always understand about the stock market. The stock market is the value of capital. or it's what the stock market thinks the capital stock, what companies are worth. So if companies get better at squeezing labor, at reducing wages, which is what we're looking at when you think of people not being as well off as their parents, that will make the stock market go up. And one of the things that's been happening in the U.S. and in other European countries is that the share of capital in national income has been going up. And that's another reason that the stock market is going up. So it's sort of like, you know, if you can replace your workers by cheaper workers from China, that's going to make the stock market go up. It's not good for American workers, but it sure is good for the stock market.
I'm wondering if you believe that the signs of prosperity for people in the middle class are fundamentally disconnected from the way people are feeling about prosperity and their future and the way their lives are panning out, and that's dangerous.
I think it is dangerous, but I think people who are feeling that they've been badly done by actually have been badly done by. You know, there's been progress for some and not so much progress for a lot of other people. And I think the people who are dying and the people who are really upset are people who really have been left behind and have not shared in the progress.
So then what does it mean for America to be great again from the perspective of an economist?
Well, I think what it needs is for that growth to be better shared, and that we've got to have policies that help wage growth among people who are not so very well educated, who are not part of the elite. It can't be all globalization or technical change, because globalization and technical change are happening to all the rich countries. And yet the bad things that have happened in America haven't happened in Britain or Germany to anything like the same extent.
Did you expect when you got into economics, studying and then becoming the Nobel Prize winning economist that you are, that you'd be looking at things like the opioid crisis as a key economic indicator?
Of course not. When I went into economics in 1969, I wouldn't have known what I had the vaguest idea what an opioid was. On the other hand, I think like many economists, certainly those of us who grew up in Britain, we entered economics because we were interested in human welfare, human well-being. And so I don't think looking at these deaths of despair or seeing how people are doing is conceptually very different from the sort of things that I started out doing. So I sort of think of it more or less as a piece, though it was sort of amusing when I got the Nobel Prize and got the famous phone call. They had a story of my intellectual life, which is much more coherent than anything I'd ever worked out. The version I'm telling you now is sort of courtesy of them.
Well, it's nice to have the Nobel Committee write your resume, that's for sure, if you ever need a job.
I'd recommend it.
Yeah, definitely recommend it. Sir Angus Deaton is the 2015 Nobel Prize-winning economist and the winner of the 2017 Franklin Founder Award. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, John. A real pleasure.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.